With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Motorsport is hosting an exclusive Reader's Evening with Audi heroes Tom Christensen, Alan McNish, number one engineer Howden H. Haynes, and the first female engineer to win Le Mans, Lena Gade. The evening will include a one-off screening of the documentary Truth in 24, filmed at the 2008 Le Mans 24-hour race, and an open forum with all the Audi stars. Don't miss out on this once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. Call Motorsport Magazine now on 020 7349 8472 for details and to book your ticket, or email readersevents@motorsportmagazine.co.uk for more information.
Motorsport Magazine, for the very best in motor racing.
Hello everybody, and welcome to this month's Motorsport Magazine podcast, which comes to you from the Goodwood Revival. We are in the Drivers Club, the best place to be if we want to talk to drivers, and we have one with us. It's Eddie Cheever. Hi Eddie, and thank you very much for coming along.
Hi, it's good to be here.
All right, what are you driving this weekend?
I'm driving a BMW, which I've already had my first session in.
What sort of BMW? An 1800 or?
I know it's got the steering wheel on the left hand side.
Is it an 1800?
I think it might be a 2000.
Oh, is it? Okay. Yeah.
It's cool.
It's quite quick enough for me, actually. If it's not 1800, it should be a 1600. But it's
the problem is that Jackie Oliver's out there in
who?
Do you know Jackie
who?
Oliver? He used to be
Oliver. Yeah. I seem to recollect something. I've got a momentary lapse. I'm sorry.
Okay. Well,
Oliver, what does he do?
Well, he was a racing driver, a bit like you, really. You know, a long time ago.
And you drove for him.
And he's also driving a BMW. Yes.
And the one that's ahead of me is what you're saying. If you lead down far enough, he's on the front row and I'm on the third.
Yeah, that's kind of what I'm saying, yeah.
Yes, I spoke to him this morning. It was good to see him. He looks very fit. I asked if he had a new girlfriend. He said, no, I have a new wife, which is somewhat the same thing. But he seems quite happy and he was having a good... He does a lot of this, Jackie. He seems to be very focused on historical racing.
I guess this is a whole lot more fun than racing for Arrows ever was.
I actually... Now that I've owned race teams and I've had to deal with race car drivers, I probably owe Jackie an apology or two for all the things I put him up to over the years. But I had a good time racing with Jackie. Jackie did everything he could to make sure we were competitive, and we had some good equipment and we had some great times, and I enjoyed it.
And your moments, though. I remember once interviewing you in the...
Harris.
That's right. And it was in the Arrows motorhome.
Yes.
And... He was the other side of a door.
Yeah.
Or we were the other side of a door.
That was Nigel, that was a private conversation. Don't do this to me publicly.
I'm not going to say what you said. No, but there were good times and bad. That's the best way of putting it, isn't it?
When you distill it all, we did a lot with what we had, and Jackie was the one that had to go out there and get the sponsorship and put it all together. So, yeah, it was difficult. Formula One is a very competitive atmosphere, and it's getting even more so now, but even then, so you were always frustrated if you were 30 horsepower down, or if you didn't have a Honda, or if you didn't have a Renault. There's always something you had to have. So from Jackie's perspective, having to deal with that all the time with two drivers that wanted to do well, with Derek and I'm sure that was not always a bowl of cherries for him either. But we did well. We had our moments.
Tell me about racing here. What brings you to the Goodwood Revival?
The first time I came here out of curiosity, because I had heard so much about it, and I tend to return more for nostalgic reasons than for competitive reasons. That doesn't mean I don't want to go fast and have the best car, which it's very difficult to get into, but it's just fun. I get to see a lot of friends. I spent years with Nigel, for example, on the Formula One Tour. It's just nice to see everybody, and it's amazing how many different generations are represented here. I've actually stood and watched John Surtees covered in grease, up to the gears in his hands, dirty like he just did the Paris Dakar working on a motorcycle. how many people can say that they've done that? This is a man that I followed when I was a kid. I mean, he drove for Ferrari. He won the championship with Ferrari. Yeah. He came from motorcycles. I mean, so there's just so many stories like that that you have here in cars that you've read about and people that you've seen and the circuit and Lord March. It's just fun. I enjoy it.
What we do like, Nigel, isn't it, is we like racing drivers who have a sense of history.
Yeah, well, you always had a sense of history. I thought you did.
I mean, I was lucky. I was very lucky.
But it's so rare. It's so uncommon to find a, you know, to find a driver who has any interest at all in the heritage of the sport.
I think I owe that to my father because he enjoyed racing, and I heard a lot of it as a child. So, and I was living in Italy. I mean, in Italy there is Ferrari, then there's the Pope.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
We were not very religious, so we spent a lot of time talking about racing and Ferrari. And
yeah. So yeah, yeah.
And I don't mean that. It sounds like I meant that humorously.
No.
Italy, literally, you can. Those are the passion. That and football.
Sure.
So
sure. And you did actually. You mean, at one point, you came close to a Ferrari drive, didn't you?
I had. Somebody reminded me that today. Today I did an interview talking about Theodore, which is the first car I raced. And it reminded me of all the stuff with Ferrari. I actually had a contract. I went to Ferrari, tested. It was when Nicky got burnt in Nürburgring. Remember when he almost died in Nürburgring?
Yeah, sure. But it was actually signed.
Done. Signed. Jeez, I received money for it. It was done. I went to Ferrari 5 times. I had to go to his office 5 times before he would rip up the contract. And I had my underwear in a knot because he had the audacity to go sign somebody else after I had broken my hand. So. Don't ask me questions about Nigel.
No. That was when Reutemann arrived.
Yes. Yeah, I was testing with Reutemann. I was there when Reutemann tested the Michelin tires for the first time.
Right. I never knew it was actually. I remember you'd tested, but I didn't know you'd actually signed the contract.
Signed, yeah.
Well, did you not go back to Enzo afterwards and say.
No. I had a broken hand. I remember I signed a good contract. I went and raced a BMW at Vallelunga for 500,000 lira. They were lira then.
How much?
I never got paid. I never got paid. So my second lap, I was dating a girl in Rome, and I wanted to show her that I was this very successful race car driver, and I go barreling into this corner, and the tire fell off, and my hand got cut between the car and the asphalt. I just mangled my left hand and my shoulder. So I went from having a Ferrari contract to being in the hospital for a month. And when I got out of that, Villeneuve had signed for Ferrari, and I decided I didn't want to do that. I had to go race Formula One, and the next car I raced was a Theodore, which had never been tested.
While we're
on the subject of Italians.
We have a senator here. I am a pleb. Here we have a senator. Senator Mazzario.
Arturo, thank you very much for joining us. You don't speak English, but you are speaking English. Okay. Tell me about what you're racing at Goodwood this weekend.
Ha detto cosa stai guidando questo weekend a Goodwood?
Sì, allora sto guidando il Millino Abarth insieme a Mauro Borella, una vettura, poi glielo traduci, no?
Sì.
La vettura che dove io ho iniziato veramente a correre nel 1963.
Arturo says that this weekend is racing a little Fiat Abarth 1000cc. That is mine, and we raced together, and he started his career on these kind of cars, and so he's very fond memories with these kind of little cars, and he's very happy to be back here with a little Abarth.
Yeah.
And then he's also racing the Ferrari
SVB.
Sure with this.
Ma yes. Poi digli che io col Millino Abarth ho debuttato e ho preso il posto di Hans Herrmann, che lui lasciava l'Abarth dopo essere stato pilota Formula 1 Mercedes e ho preso e ho iniziato la mia carriera.
Actually he started his career when Hans Herrmann, that is here, left Abarth. And so he did come over and took his place in the Abarth Works team on this kind of car that is racing today here in Goodwood.
Okay. Mm. Well, I tell you what, if you're listening to this podcast in Italy, you're going to hear these answers twice. Once in English.
He does speak English, by the way.
I know he does.
And he does speak English,
I
by the way, so
does.
Don't let him... Don't.
He's already spoken English to me.
Yes.
I'd like to ask both of you a fairly obvious question, but I think people are interested, is that a lot of Grand Prix racing fans would love to see an Italian driver drive for the Ferrari Grand Prix team, but it just doesn't seem to happen, does it?
Well, Michele, I mean... You know,
Michele was the last one.
You mean, no.
Arturo drove for Ferrari. Ferrari has to win championships. They have to pick the best drivers that are available. I mean, it goes... I remember when I was racing in Formula 1, there was this wave of French drivers. Si ricordi, prima sono arrivati I piloti italiani, then the French, and then the Germans. It just depends. It often dependent on where Marlboro was spending the most money. The Swedes. I mean, how many drivers did Marlboro produce in the countries?
Arturo, what we're talking about is for the Ferrari Grand Prix team having so few Italian drivers in recent years.
Dopo tu traduci, effettivamente non c'è nessuno all'altezza in questi ultimi 10 anni, purtroppo. Mentre quando ho lasciato io la Ferrari, Eddie per esempio, lui era predicato per andare alla Ferrari, lui non c'è andato per altri motivi che in pochi sanno, ma lui doveva essere il pilota Ferrari prima di Michele.
Certo. Nazario says that there is a very simple reason because in the last 10 years he thinks that there is no any Italian driver that can be so good to be chosen for the Ferrari team. But at his time, in the 70s, for example, Eddie Cheever was looked after by Ferrari to be a Ferrari works driver. Then it didn't happen for various reasons, but by then there were more people that could drive a Ferrari. And Merzario thinks that in recent year they choose non-Italian drivers just because there is not Italian driver that can be
Ferrari.
Can we come back to Goodwood for a second? I just want to talk to you about driving this circuit because I know a lot of people, you know, come and watch here. And just tell us about a lap because it's quick, isn't it?
No, there's quick and then there's Goodwood quick. It's really quick. It's an old circuit with a lot of history on it. How do you say this politically correctly? There's a few places where you would not want to go off. And the cars are fast. I mean, these cars at their era, a lot of people made mistakes. So dicendo che il circuito è molto veloce e ci sono dei punti dove non vuoi uscire.
Spiega, quando io venivo a fare I collaudi con la Williams
BRM. Welcome to the Italian version of the Motorsport Podcast.
Arturo tells me when he came and tested with Williams and BRM. There's a sign you do in Italy where you put two hands
74.
Out as if you're measuring the width of your midsection.
My heart.
And he was saying you had to be very brave, and he's touching his heart. Saying, it's one of those circuits where you've really got to tighten the lower seatbelts to make sure you get around it quick. There's lots of fast corners. But I can almost feel the ghost walking through all the rooms of all the drivers that have been here. Arturo says a lot of adverse camber, which is true.
Yeah, that's true. Are you driving? I thought you were driving a Cobra.
And I'm driving a Cobra.
Have you been out in it yet?
I have not. I'm not having wine for lunch. Wine is not on the list today. I've heard it is a handful.
Have you? But you never driven one before.
I've never driven one. No, Keke had one. I've never driven.
Yeah, he did have one. That's right. Yeah.
But you are going to need to be brave in that, aren't you?
I would say that bravery always played a more important role in how I drove than intelligence. So I might just fit into that one. it's fun. I like doing it. Well, I raced here with a Jaguar once in the TT, and it was a handful. We're so used to driving new cars with great brakes and perfect steering and all the tires and great suspension. These cars have defects. That's the charm of it.
Can I ask you quickly about racing in America before you go? Because again, you know, there are very few American heroes at the moment, aren't there? There's a lot of Brazilians, a lot of English, Scots, of course.
IndyCar racing is unrecognizable, isn't it?
The American school for drivers is completely focused on NASCAR. A successful NASCAR driver can make $50 million in a year. It's unbelievable. It's an aberration of nature, of how much volume they have and people that come in this segment of the population that watches it. Underneath that, a long way down the ladder, economically, is IndyCars. So when you're a young race car driver, you now aspire to race at Daytona.
Yeah.
The Daytona 500. You don't aspire to do other races other than the Indy 500. So the problem is there's no place for them to learn. So a lot of drivers that cannot make it in Formula 1 end up racing in IndyCar, and they do a very good living. Franchitti is fabulous in IndyCar. He's fabulous on an oval. I mean, he's typical Scottish race car, very tidy, very quiet, very underspoken.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much, Eddie Cheever, Arturo Mazzario.
Thank you.
Mille grazie. Thank you very much. Well, with us, joining us at the motorsport table now is Nick Mason, who, of course, has his absolutely gorgeous Ferrari GTO here for the revival at Goodwood. Nick, somebody told me today that when you bought this car, you paid literally thousands for it, whereas now they're worth millions and millions. This is remarkable.
Yes, I suppose it is really, but sadly, I never really learnt the lesson that, I mean, when I think back and think of all the other cars I was offered and turned down, I really should have cornered the market with old bangers at the time.
Is there one particular that stands out in your mind as the one you missed?
Oh yes, there was a point where I was offered a Bugatti Atlantique and a Zagato as a package, and thought that maybe it was a little bit overpriced. I can't even remember what the money was now. But
it was sort of more than 40 grand.
But it's the sort of thing that still occasionally haunts me.
Anyway, how long ago was that?
A long time ago, late 70s,
right.
I should think. Beg your pardon. Yeah, no, late 70s. Right. Yeah. The thing is, of course, that's interesting about it is that I was considered to be a complete idiot at the time. I paid an absolute record price for a GTO. And at the time, we hadn't really seen the writing on the wall that all these cars were going to become so valuable. And it's sort of curious because they were already beginning to climb, but no one could see it as the sort of explosion that would occur later. And I have to say, the with all the cars that I've bought that have been great investments, I always bought them with my heart rather than head. None of them were ever seen as an investment. They were always just cars that I really lusted after.
I think,
I was going to say, is it true also that the car, when you bought the car, it had 250 GTO? It had the plate already.
Which had been produced by a previous owner. But the most interesting thing about that was when he handed me the logbook, he also handed me the old logbook with its original registration, which was something like 4HLY. Now, I then remembered that I had a picture that I'd taken as a kid, well, like a teenager anyway, at Goodwood here, when I'd come with my dad, who was head of photographers past, and we were at the chicane, and I'd actually found the picture. It must have been Peter, who was it, who had it? First owner after Correa Franc-Conchamp, Peter Clark. And it must have been Peter driving it in about 64, I should think.
Yeah.
And I recognised it immediately. I mean, I recognised the number plate from the picture that I still had that I'd taken then.
We've just been joined by Sir Stirling Moss, who probably wishes he'd kept all the cars he ever raced.
Any of them, actually. But there's a lot of them here, quite a few cars. What amazes me is how many Keiths have been copied. I mean, we built one, and then I think another one was built, and now, my God, there's a fleet of them out there. It's amazing.
Yes, we're not mad about replicas, are we?
No, exactly.
No.
But then, I mean, Nick's got the... I said to him once, you know, what about his birdcage? He said, which one? And of course, I'd forgotten that
that's showing off, isn't it?
I'd forgotten that there was a 2-litre as well. You know, one doesn't think of that one.
Sterling, I got to say, you look as pecker as ever. What's the secret?
That's actually a cruise for a week in the Mediterranean. Get a suntan. You could be dying, and if you've got a suntan, people say, my God, you're looking well. I am feeling well, in all truth. I'm feeling very, very well, but that was the reason for it.
But you've retired, haven't you? Now?
I have retired from racing. Not from driving and not from maybe hill climbs and stuff, but I have retired from racing.
You were in a Porsche. Was this an RSK? At Le Mans, the day you decided that's
enough. Extraordinary. I've never had it happen before. I went round this corner and I thought, you know, if I'm going to be competitive, I'm going to be frightened. Because it just frightened me, not sheer speed, but the speed of going through the corners. And I thought, you know, I'm not going to do this if I'm going to be frightened. I've frightened myself, silly, but never like that. And that was enough.
I mean, was it because the car? I mean, you were racing your Oscar.
Yeah.
But the RSK was obviously going to be appreciably quicker than that.
No,
was it suddenly getting into something faster?
No, that may have been possible. It was just a feeling I had that if I'm going to be competitive, I've got to go quickly. And I was going as fast as I wanted to go, and it was nowhere near quick enough. Right. So I thought, that's it. Get out.
Right. And you'd never, ever had even a vague thought of that before?
Never before. I mean, even when I broke my legs and my back and stuff, I never thought of giving up. I just wanted to get out and get on to the next race.
It's taken 40-odd years to make the connection.
Well, I think this is a fantastic little group, actually, because we've been joined by Martin Brundle, former Grand Prix driver and obviously now broadcaster. So we got two generations, and also a man, you know, who brings these amazing cars to our events. So this is a joyous moment. Martin, I got to ask you about Formula One first, then we'll have a word about Goodwood. But what a season. Thrilling season, yes?
It is. It's wonderful sitting here. I'm sitting with a former teammate. People never believe that I was a teammate with Sir Stirling
Moss. Can, and Dan were pissed on me, actually. It was bravado of youth is what I put it down to.
And front-wheel drive.
Age and treachery will always beat youth and talent. You know that, Stirling. And my team boss of the weekend as well, with the Ferrari. It has been a wonderful Formula One season. We've had 13 races. I can count 11 of those that I thought were thrilling. I've been so lucky to be lead commentator this year. A couple of them I thought were a bit steady. Australia and
Malaysia.
Valencia. Malaysia had its moments, but it's been exciting. Lots of arguments of whether all the goodies that help overtaking are pure racing or good. What I do know is that we've got the biggest audiences ever on British TV for Formula One that have been recorded, and more importantly, they peak at the beginning of the race and they're still there at the end of the race, so the fans are liking it. And as I always say, if we're not doing it for the fans, let's race on a Wednesday afternoon and have the weekends off.
Now, what I am interested in is what instructions has team boss Nick Mason given Martin Brundle for this weekend?
I've only given him one instruction so far, if he can remember it.
Yes, he said, Nick said to me last week when we were testing, he said, I don't want it looking like this when it comes back. And it sat there gleaming, absolutely gleaming. I said, what do you mean? You mean you want some flies and some oil on it or something? And he said, no, I want dents and scratches on it. Because last year I jumped out of the way every time anybody came anywhere near me, because the car is worth a few shillings.
You know these rock stars, you know. Anyway.
But he did say, don't roll it over if you can help it.
You'd like a go in the GTO, Stirling, wouldn't you?
No, not now. Since I retired, no. I would have given anything for that before.
Stirling has driven the car a while ago now, but you...
That isn't the one I drove at Le Mans, though, is it?
No.
Because I drove one at Le Mans, I remember. And in fact, we were in the lead till we were third overall in the lead of the class until 4 a.m. And then the fan blade came off because Canetti hadn't removed it, which he should have done, which was stupid. I mean, the car was so fantastic. I mean, it really is. But is it as nice to drive as a short wheelbase?
Oh, I think so.
Do you?
Yeah. I mean, be interesting. You just have another drive in it sometime.
Yeah.
See what you think.
Well, I know it's going to be slower, but the short wheelbase always struck me as such a beautifully balanced car.
I think it's absolutely got the same balance, and that's the attraction of the car. Some ways, it's a slightly more sophisticated version with a 5-speed box and so on.
Yeah.
But I suspect the general handling is very similar.
Yeah.
Sorry about Zebedee, that's M. Brundle's telephone. Can you tell us, Martin, what it is like to drive this car at Goodwood? You know, try and describe to us the lap in this wonderful machine.
Well, it's a great privilege, as you can imagine, and the gearbox and the engine, the wail of the V12, the click-clack of the gearbox, the car takes off like a scolded cat. You use the steering wheel to gently point it towards the corner, and then you use the throttle pedal to control the amount of turn thereafter, which is not quite the sort of racing I was used to, but it is truly spectacular. And you know, the reason I love coming to the Revival and driving cars like that is I don't know how often I'll have that opportunity. And to go through Ford water and leave your foot planted on the floor.
You're flat out at Ford water, are you?
It will go flat out through Ford water.
You've been flat
once,
out.
Once, backwards.
No, Reg Parnell said to me, by the way, is Ford water flat? I said, yes, if you get it right. He lost it. You have been through flat, though.
Yes, I have been through there flat, yes.
Very interesting.
But it will do it. It gets a little bit lively on the downslope, the other side of it. And Adrian D-Type was flat through there as well. but I don't. I'm always nervous there'll be some oil or something around there. So you leave a margin. But the wonderful thing about today, about those days, Sterling, is there was no data acquisition, so you can't have some bright young thing with a piece of graph paper coming up to you saying, "Excuse me, I think you find you weren't flat at all."
Martin, I remember you telling me it was an early revival, and you, I think you were in a D type. And Sterling, was Sterling in the same race in an Aston?
Yeah.
Because I can't remember, did he pass you or?
No, I was in Coombsy's yellow D type.
Yeah.
I was basically, my main job was to stop it from crashing, I felt, until it lost a few cylinders. And then I had this moment going into St Mary's. I thought Sterling was in a D type as well, and I looked across because he was coming through, and there was Sir Sterling Moss looking straight ahead. He didn't look at me, looking straight ahead into St Mary's, and I thought it won't get any better than that. But then it did. When I drove the 250 GTO here last year, I hadn't had a chance to test it, went out of the assembly area, going up through the gearbox, so this feels magnificent, just what I expected, through Madwick, and the air show was just finishing, and through my field of vision came what I think is a Spitfire, might have been a Mustang, I wasn't really counting at the time, and I thought, it won't get any better than that. Well, maybe it will.
No.
Nowhere else in the world, eh? Fantastic. Nick, I must say, it's a bit of a privilege, isn't it, to have sort of these guys in your cars. Are you sort of thinking, oh, I ought to be in there, or have you retired like Sir Sterling?
I have sort of decided to do a bit less, certainly, and I'm really enjoying it. No, I don't feel I should be in there. I mean, one of the great things about having Martin and Mark in the car is actually to see the car being driven that, you know, considerably better. I really enjoy motor racing. I've enjoyed a lot of it. But in now, the sort of level of competition at Goodwood, I'd rather have the car driven properly.
Sterling, the thing about historic racing is that the cars that we see somewhere like the Goodwood Revival are very usable. The problem is, in the future, they won't be at all usable, will they?
Well, why won't they?
Well, I thought you had to have a laptop to start them and all this.
Oh, you mean the modern cars? Oh, good God, no, we don't want that crap around. No. I mean, no, quite honestly, a modern car doesn't compare with the beauty of the old ones. I mean, that's what you're talking about. The old ones carry on, of course we will. I mean, they're going to be here. I'm sure all the cars are here. And look how many cars are here that were never built. You know, I mean, how many bird cages and D-types and all these other exotica actually exist now? Quite a lot, you know.
Well, I'm sure I saw Sebastian Vettel power sliding that Red Bull through the Ascari at Monza last weekend.
Yeah.
That was a rare sight.
I must say, I want to speak to Martin about, he seems to be head and shoulders above everybody else. Vettel.
I agree with you.
I mean, he's got a good car. We know he's got the best car. He's got a great engineer and everything else. But my God, he's good, isn't he?
I said at the end of the race in Monza, I think you have to start considering him alongside the greats now. I asked Nigel that over dinner that night, and he wasn't so sure. A lot of fans think that he can only race from the front, and he's not that, you know, he can't overtake. Well, that's because he's always at the front, because he's so bloody quick in qualifying.
Yeah, and there wasn't much wrong with the way he passed Alonso on Sunday, was there?
There absolutely wasn't. And it's Vettel as in kettle, not Vettel as in David Coulthard. No, we got over Highfield, but then he retired anyway. But I love working with DC. I must add that straight away.
But Vettel, I mean, he's such a funny bloke, isn't he? I mean, as a person, he's a tremendous personality.
Well, no, he is, and he's an engaging young man. He's interesting. He's intelligent. You
not
see
big-headed
that in and
in
out
any
of
way,
the car.
Is he?
And he's the only driver smart enough to spend social time and go on holiday with Bernie Ecclestone. Now that is a smart move to be a successful Formula One driver.
Yes, I was watching them just before the start, actually, Bernie and Sebastian. I mean, Sebastian took to Bernie. Bernie took to Sebastian immediately, didn't he?
He did, and he, you know, Bernie's the circus master, and Vettel's a great circus act, and he's a nice kid.
I just wish he'd stop jabbing the finger. That's, everybody agrees about that.
Apart from him.
Well, yeah. Paul McCartney has a nasty habit of doing something similar on stage. You know, it can be forgiven one failing, I think. No, I'd say that I've really enjoyed watching it, the racing this season. I think not only with Sebastian Vettel, but actually a lot of the others have all really earned their living this year. And that's what's great. I mean, some of those races, you've seen 8-10 people truly performing and deserving the sort of money they get paid. And I think that makes good television.
There have been over 850 competitive on-track passes so far this season after Monza. 8 lead changes in the first 18 laps in Spa. And then we saw Webber going around the outside of Alonso in Eau Rouge, which is etched in my memory. Sadly, Alonso cruised past him with DRS wide open the very next lap, which we don't talk so much about.
That's right. I mean, DRS at Spa was a joke, I thought.
It wasn't optimised, I think that's the expression.
As it was in Turkey.
Same thing. What's your take on DRS?
I would have enjoyed the idea, but I don't know if I'd have liked to race with it that much. I'm interested in anything that improves the car, yes, from that point of view, but I think it gives an... I don't know, without driving the thing and feeling what the benefit is, where the benefit can come, how I can use it and so on, I wouldn't like to give an opinion. But it's obviously a bit of clever gear.
Damon Hill said that he wouldn't want to overtake and then someone comes straight back past him with a flappy wing.
Well, I don't know. I don't know. I hold my judgment till I've tried something. I do think KERS is the most important thing, though, because I personally believe that every car in the world is likely to have KERS in 10 years' time, because you're getting something for nothing. And I think that motor racing is the place to test it, and it's doing the right job, and they're finding out different things. And I think it's a fantastic idea.
Okay. Thank you very much, all of you. Thank you. Joining us now is Rauno Altonen, who I hope doesn't need any introduction, but I mean one of the true greats of rally driving. But today, Rauno, you're out on the circuit, obviously, and your ears are ringing. Why?
Well, you see, 40 years professional career in motorsport, not wearing earplugs often enough means that my ears are a bit sensitive. I can't go to a disco, for instance. But I love it hearing, you know, a powerful engine. And now I was using earplugs, so I'm all right. It was great 2 training sessions this morning.
Tell us what you're racing at this year's Goodwood Revival.
I will be driving in the St. Mary's Trophy with a 1300 Mini from 1964. This is Richard Longman's old famous Mini. But obviously it has many engines since then, and anyway, I had this pleasure to drive this car, and it went very smoothly. Maybe we could have a little bit more power, but which racing driver doesn't say that, you know? You have to find an excuse at least. Then I've been driving a Jaguar E-Type. That is again a different world. It's a little bit more powerful and faster, of course. Rear-wheel drive, a bit more sideways. So that's a different world, but I love it. I like going sideways
is
as
this,
well.
Is it the first time you've driven the driven a racing E-Type?
No, I've been driving last time 2 years ago.
Oh, we were in an E-Type here?
Yes, I've been running here.
Forgive me.
But the thing is, that's 2 years, and in 2 years you do forget certain things. So it's wiser to build up the speed and not just take, you know, a rubber straight away and make some silly spins.
No, sure.
Lap times were not as good as I expected, but they will improve.
I would imagine, I may be wrong, but a man who's prepared to drive flat out through a forest in the middle of the night, a few laps of Goodwood is no big deal, is it?
The word no big deal is maybe a little bit soft expression, because the point is here, same as in the rally, between the trees, we are fighting for a hundredth of a second, which means that any time you turn the steering wheel 1 inch too much, that means, oh, again, 0.001 second was gone. So it is an immense concentration to have your smooth lines, still maintaining a nice drift, because a tire does not make any side force without having this so-called slip angle, which looks like the drift for the whole car. So this is this balance between a nice, purposeful drift, not too much working with the steering, and keeping your right foot reasonably flat on the floor.
Where does the where are you flat for most of the lap in the Mini?
Yes. We are, yes.
Really? Yeah.
So it's a matter of keeping the rhythm around the lap, yes?
That's right, because although my right foot is flat on the floor, every time I turn the steering wheel, the revs drop. and it means that it's vital in these relatively low-powered cars to have a smooth line and especially come out of the bend without a drift. This is vital. That is costing money for the whole length of a straight.
Do you? Is this a track you like, you enjoy?
Well, if you think about a rally, a special stage, has every 50 meters a corner and trees are so that you are touching them maybe slightly, but hopefully only with rear bumper, which doesn't matter. So here in Goodwood, it is, you know, vast area, beautiful big green fields, but the speeds are so high that I know this from experience, once you leave the tarmac, you have a feeling that you have just lightened a rocket and you're accelerating when you get onto the grass. And it appears to go forever. So even the big areas of grass don't guarantee that you are not going to hit the wall.
No.
Please tell me what you think about modern World Rally Championship, because we don't see those wonderful, really powerful turbocharged rear-wheel cars, you know, stones flying sideways. What's your take on the modern?
Well, first of all, I feel sorry for the public spectators, because the Group B cars, they were lovely to look at and they were lovely to drive. I love them more. But development must go ahead. Today's world for this kind of cars, it is four-wheel drive. And now the question is that as all makes will have to have this one type four-wheel drive transmission, and you don't have a center differential, you have mechanical limited slips, front axle, rear axle, which means that it takes a lot of skill and experience and testing to adjust the limited slip differential so that the car is in balance. And of course, suspension, it requires a lot of working to make the car to be in balance. But as somebody said to me, that the modern rally cars, they are really to drive, because when you would like to turn it, they go straight, and when you want to go straight, they spin. But I mean, this makes it sport. Doesn't it? So I think it's not a bad thing.
Nigel, I know that you're a huge fan of Sebastian Loeb, aren't you? I mean,
I'm a huge fan of Loeb's, but I'm a bit mystified about what's been going on this year in that team. I mean, at one time it seemed as though Ogier was being favoured, and now it seems to have swung back again, and now people are talking about, well, is Ogier going to leave? There does seem to have been sort of quite a lot of gamesmanship at that in Citroën this
well,
year.
Well, you see, the moment we deal with human beings, if we would like to exclude emotions, it would be boring.
Yeah, no,
so,
I agree.
So it is all about emotions, and you get the driver gets his adrenaline up when he wants to win. And if he's told you can't win, you're not allowed to win, then you better go and eat sandwiches.
Did you have that experience of that in your rally career? Were there times when you were asked to?
I wasn't asked. I was told.
You were told. Yeah.
And well, I accepted. You know, if I have made an agreement and I signed it, and the team manager is the boss, so he has all the rights to say that. I'm not bitter about that, but I am bitter because he didn't pay my share of the prize money as promised. I mean, this is nasty.
Yes. Did that just happen once, or
it happened very often? You know,
very often.
Well, but you know, I get used to it, and that's part of it.
Difficult though. I mean, if being as competitive as you were.
No, you see, but there are other competitive people, and it depends who has points at the moment in championships.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I fully accept if you're a professional to do that.
Yeah.
But if something is promised, people should keep their words.
Yes.
But
absolutely.
I think it's not only in a motorsport where the words are not being kept in today's world.
That's perfectly true.
Rana, before you go, I must ask you, what do you think was your greatest victory? Okay, I know you had so many of them, but what's the one you really felt that was a brilliant drive?
Well, people don't know about this victory. It is a Spa-Sofia Liège, 1964 in a Healey 3000. That is my personally biggest victory, because that was really long and really tough.
Yeah.
No special stages. It was like, you know, today, these cannonball races.
Yes, yes.
Full speed, open roads, meeting trucks and lorries opposite way. Quite interesting.
And in a serious car, too.
Oh, yes, a quick car.
Quick car,
yes. When to get an idea about the power we had, the rear wheels on dirt roads would last the tires 160 kilometers, and then there would be nothing else but canvas left, no rubber.
Really?
Those were the days.
That was great fun.
Yeah.
Thank you, Rano Altonen. Fantastic. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Rano.
I guess you do podcast. Yeah, you're pretty technical, aren't you, with the computer?
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Computers and the...
Not at all. I have no clue.
I remember you once told me, Gerhard, when I asked you if you'd like to drive a modern Formula One car, you told me that actually you have to get your daughter to turn your television on for you.
Yeah, but it's true. Absolutely true. It's still the same. still the same. And I actually don't want to know how you turn it on and off, because otherwise I just have to do it. I like to lay down and get the job done by somebody others.
So you can't operate a DVD player or anything like that, then?
Well, it's just a very simple one. That's why I'm racing in Goodwood, because these cars where you still have a steering wheel, a throttle, and a brake.
Anyway, I'm sorry. We should have introduced Gerhard Berger. Former Grand Prix driver, obviously, famously with Ferrari and McLaren and many other things.
Hey,
and
in fact,
I'm sorry, I'm not talking to the media. I do not want to talk to the media.
No, we know this.
As you may have gathered, everybody, that we've also been joined by Sir Jackie Stewart. So now we have two wonderful Grand Prix drivers with us. Nigel.
Rob has asked me to get you to tell the story about Jean Todt's Alpha.
All what I remember is that it was a Lancia, not a Alpha.
Well, you came into the car park, didn't you?
Let me think. It's a long time ago. I have a little bit Alzheimer's, so it's a bit difficult. Dot had backed a Lancia. Do you know the story, Jackie?
Do you know the story?
Yeah? No. So we went lunch in Maranello. We had just the first time the Formula One car out for this season, Jean Alesi and me. And everything was very nervous because new season just started, brand new car. Mechanics was just putting everything together. We went to lunch. We came back. And we've been in front of the office of Jean Todt, and we didn't have a car to go over to the racetrack. And I said to Jean, look, there is a car. And look, there is a key on. Let's take the car. That was a Lancia. So we driven, and you know, in Maranello, you have to go outside, and then you come in and again on the track.
No, I don't know.
Okay, anyway. Anyway, Jean driven the car like an idiot. I was working on the handbrake. And just when we came close to the new Formula One car, somehow the car got a strange movement on the handbrake, and we start to roll it, and we just 1 meter away from the new Formula One on the roof, we just crashed into the barrier. You know? So the mechanic took them 10 minutes to get us out of the car. You know,
irresponsible racing driver.
Yeah,
I mean, this is what
that's
we're
why we
dealing
didn't
with.
That's why we didn't drive for you,
Sir.
You would never take us.
He would never have driven at Stuart Grand Prix behaving like that.
Absolutely.
Never heard of anything so ridiculous.
Cantorell told me once. He's looking for me, but the only way that I could drive for him is if I start to use a tie.
Yeah. And for the listeners, actually, Berger's never owned a tie in his life and doesn't know how to do it. He did wear one at the wedding of Prince Albert, but he got somebody else to tie it for him.
Is that
absolutely
a fact?
True. It's a fact. Yeah.
That is true, is it?
It's
a bit like the video recorder. I don't know how to put it on.
So Jackie,
I have some print tips.
Now, I mean, this sort of thing never went on at Tyrol, I would imagine.
Tyrol's team, no, there was no nonsense like that. I did roll a car once at Kyalami, a passenger car, and we were coming back from dinner, and we went into a polo field in a Volkswagen, and I did the handbrake job, and the damn thing, it went forward, and then the wheels turned inwards, and the damn thing rolled over. And the young lady that was sitting in the passenger seat, I ended up on top of her. And I said, my God, for 5 years I've been dreaming about this.
Jackie, I'm so happy that you told this, because I don't never tell the movement of my car, because it was exactly the same. It rolled over the front wheel, you know. It was so strange, and we had no seatbelts on, so we end up nose on nose with Sean Lacey. But you know what was funny also? Was funny. They have, as a rule, an ambulance car has to be in Maranello. Always stand by when the cars goes out. So the ambulance car with a running engine been there for the Formula One cars. And 25 years they never had a work. That was the first time they had finally a crash. So the ambulance came and took Sean Lacey to the hospital. That was the first time that we had something to do.
What do you both think about Jean's plans to do, maybe to do Indy?
I told him, Jean, why do you want to do Indy? Your strength in Formula One was always late braking and the rain. In Indy we don't have late braking, we don't have rain. So why would you like to do this?
What do you think?
Well, I think he's a brave man. I mean, I don't know what age Jean is right now.
47.
Well, that's quite young for Indianapolis.
Head, 21. Looking 70. Yeah.
But, I, you know, it's a scary place. I mean, I loved the race I did there. The only race I did properly there, I did it twice, actually. And I enjoyed it much more than I thought I would. And I had a fantastic race that went on for 300 or 400 miles. And the manners were very good. I mean, people like Parnelli Jones was fantastic to see. So smooth. You talk about who's smooth and who's ragged. Parnelli Jones was as smooth as silk. And I had a great Roger McCluskey, I think it was. I had a great... We must have passed, I don't know, 30, 40 times. But you slipstreamed. You knew when to pass. He was intelligent. I was trying to be intelligent. And you always... There was no drama.
Yeah.
But... It's not as boring as people think, but it is dangerous if you get out of line, because you're talking about concrete walls.
At 200 miles an hour.
I like that finally gives me a reason to go, because if Sean Alesi is doing Indianapolis, I never seen it, I never been there. That's a reason why to go there. And I love Sean. I would wish he doesn't do it, because I hope he doesn't hurt himself at this stage. But if he likes to do it, I'm going to be his biggest fan there.
Yeah, you could be the right man there for giving him advice and so forth. And keeping all these American girls away from him. And you could handle that very well. You're an expert in that area.
Jackie, while we're on the subject of comebacks, if we can call Jean Alesi's a comeback, can I just ask you to briefly tell us what you have thought and seen about of Michael Schumacher this Formula One season?
Well, I think the last race that Michael drove, he drove extremely well. I mean, you couldn't have done better than he did to keep Lewis Hamilton behind him for that number of laps. I mean, he was blocking, and he was blocking like Michael Schumacher knows how to block. I mean, I thought it went on a little too long, the blocking, and he might have been penalised more heavily for it, but he actually drove a good race. The only problem I have with him is that I think he retired probably 2 years too early, because he was lost out of the cockpit. He didn't enjoy his retirement at all. I mean, to have to go and drive motorcycles, race motorcycles, to get the buzz going again, it just doesn't work for me, a man of that quality. And I think had he raced two more years, he would have wanted to retire, really wanted. Because I think I told Nigel not too long ago that I nearly retired 2 years before I did. I nearly retired 1 year before I did. But when I retired, it was absolutely the right decision. And I think my only criticism of Michael, and it's not his fault, timing's everything in life, and I think he retired too early.
Gerhard, do you think you retired too late or too early?
I don't agree with Jackie. I have a different opinion. I think Michael did a fantastic job in his career, 7-time world champion, most anybody ever did. He gave us a lot of pleasure watching him in the races. He committed 150% year by year, and now he still would like to do racing. He still enjoys it. He wants to go in a racing car. He have fun on it, and teams still want him, and he's still doing a good job. I mean, yeah, he's not anymore on the level of Sebastian Vettel, Hamilton, Rosberg, of the young ones, but straight away behind, it's him. So as long teams want him, as long he likes to do it, I think he should have the pleasure to do it.
But see, but Gerhard, what Nicky says is, but you don't do Formula One for fun.
Why? You do Formula
One. Not Formula One. You maybe do touring cars, but not Formula One.
It's not true. I mean, if you have no fun in racing, you don't do anything good. I mean, I find it completely wrong. I mean, Formula One, every racing you go in, every job you're doing, you have to do for fun if you want to be really good. You have to enjoy it. And, I mean, it's the market. If he's not good enough, nobody would take him. But he's still good enough. People still want him. He wants to do it. So why should we do the decision for him? It's his life.
So, Jackie, I think, I know you have very little time.
Why are you dying?
He's always been a very funny man. He's taken more out of himself in his life than I ever took out of myself in my life.
They do say never work with children, animals or Gerhard Berger.
Well, the trouble with the Gerhard Berger factor is that he normally has such an entourage of really attractive women after him. That's one of the biggest problems with Gerhard.
Jackie, can you be a little bit more discreet?
Too late, Gerhard. Too late. Too late. Anyway, so Jackie, thank you very much for joining us. And you're in the Juan Manuel Fangio tribute?
Yes, I'm driving his wonderful 250F lightweight Maserati that he won the great 1957 German Grand Prix round the real Nürburgring. And he was 30 seconds behind at the start of the last lap and beat Hawthorn and Collins in that very car. And I think I know how he did it. The accelerator pedal's in the middle. And I think he thought he was pressing the brake pedal most of the time, but he was in fact pressing the accelerator pedal. I can't think of another reason that he would make up that much time.
We'll remember it tomorrow. Thank you very much, Jackie. Thank you. We're joined by... Carry on, Gerhard.
Yes, I'm hungry.
You're hungry? Okay, go. Okay. Mr. Berger, yeah. Yeah, thank you very much. Thank you both. Tom Christensen, thank you so much for joining us. I know it's a busy day for you as well, like all these guys. But why is an 8 times Le Mans winner racing at the Goodwood Revival?
Yeah, I don't know. I guess you have to ask. I mean, particularly Lord Marsh. He invited me last year at the Geneva Auto Salon. We were at the dinner table, and he had mentioned a few times. I should come to the revival as well, and I always thought the revival means old, so maybe I shouldn't go there. But then, being here and accepting last year, I was overwhelmed by the first moment. I've seen pictures from here, I've heard a little bit, but you know, when you're here and you see that everyone is dressed up, everyone is a part of the act, everyone have put a lot of effort and thinking into how they want to look. Look at you guys. I mean, you look fantastic in your outfit. I'm sure you don't wear this in your daily life and modern time. And I think that is what is very unique about it. You see, everyone feels a part of it. You see, modern racing. You come to a race meeting, and it's a little bit like they are there to see the show or to be see the race, but maybe sometimes they can have a bad day. Here, everyone have a good day.
You, last year, you had a truly fantastic race. Just tell us a little bit about it, because it was, I'll never forget it.
I happened to drive this very beautiful Austin Westminster, which in the beginning I thought that when they pointed at it, that they pointed at the car was which was behind it, because it absolutely doesn't look like a race car, does it? I mean, I thought it was a London taxi which was parked wrongly, but then they kindly had put my name on the side of it, so I thought, Jesus Christ. But to be honest, that six-cylinder, straight six, it had very good power. And the handling was quite good for the first 3-4 laps. Then the tires really started to go off. So, but this the owner told me. He told me about that. He said, "Tom, it's important that you do the lap times quite early. It's important in the race that actually we started on the front row. I don't remember where, but on the front row, it was a fantastic race with Patrick Watts in a Volvo Amazon. He was all over me for a lot of times, and we had a great fight, and we had to use the grass a little bit, but it was all we never touched. The only thing we were doing the race, I was touched by a little small mosquito late in the race when my tires were really going down, and I realized after that it was this Austin with Martin Brundle, who he could so easily have won the race if he just was a little bit more a little bit calm at the situation. He just touched me a little bit, and that was enough to have a puncture. But yeah, to be first on over the line was maybe not something nobody expected, certainly not me, and a bit of luck was in it, but it was the respect of the historic racing, and that people and cars are fragile. But it was a lovely time, and since then I like to be here.
So Tom, what are you in this year?
I'm in a Lotus Cortina, British heritage, fantastic little car. It handles okay. Now we are in the 60s of the touring cars, and I can feel already a big difference from the 56 Austin Westminster. Now you are 8 years longer down the road, and now you certainly have a handling car. You have the suspension, which is working. There's still a lot of body roll. There's not so much power, but you have a car which is much better balanced. And then later, which is I will be out in the AC Cobra, the Shelby Daytona, in the TT race. Yeah. So for sure, I will not ask for more power in that car.
have you driven that yet?
Yes, I just done a few laps with the car here last week. A 15-minute session.
And what were your first impressions?
The first impression is your eyes get really really big. You are. Your right foot gets really, really, you know, you get all the feelings go down in the right foot, because, I mean, basically the car understeers. If you go into a corner and you turn, it understeers until you hit the throttle. If you hit the throttle, it oversteers.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. It oversteers. So you have to find sort of an in-betweener. But then at the same time, when then the leaf springs kick in, or the whole chassis of the aluminium chassis, you sort of have always to think, two steps ahead, and that is what is it's a car which I believe nobody ever can fall asleep in, because you're constantly reminded that it breaks a bit out of balance.
I was at Silverstone last weekend watching the Autosport 6 hours, and you've moved planets, haven't you, in the space of the last few days? It's a different world, completely different world in every way.
It is, and but I have to say, I mean, I'm here. We speak now a lot about the cars, but I think Goodwood is more about the cars. But in the cars itself, of course, the prototypes we drive today, ultra lightweight, as we call them at Audi, the R18, small six-cylinder engine, single turbo, electronic gearbox, LED lights, all is done to save weight and still getting a very, very good performance. And what you can do today in terms of this, the gravity, the center of gravity, the way you build the carbon chassis, I mean, it's such a long way, and then to go back here. But I'm here basically for the whole event to be here, and I think that's really important. That the whole thing is just taking overwhelming to be here, to be still younger than the times is here, 50s and 60s. It's a chance for me to see how my dad's generation behaved or what they drove. I have my dad here this year. And I brought him here, and I haven't seen him since. But he was a racing driver, and he's walking around. But just to see that and experience that together, that's wonderful.
That's lovely.
Just finally, Tom, can I ask you? I have to ask you about Audi at the moment, because at Silverstone, Alan touched another car. It happened at Le Mans. Can you give us some insight into why this is such a big problem when you're in a Peugeot or an Audi, because you're in a different league from the other cars.
Yeah, no, but basically the competition is competition, of course, bites, and that means that when Audi this year, our sister car, win Le Mans by 18.852 seconds over 24 hours, then you can understand if you just hesitate behind 10 cars, I mean, or hesitate a little bit too much, yeah, all right, then Peugeot might win. So if you get this, then we have to be relatively fast, and there's a lot of trust between drivers, but there are different mentalities. They are driving their race. The GT race is incredibly competitive too, so they will also want to have the corners. They have slowed down the prototypes on the straights. We have, as I say, downsizing six-cylinder engine, so on the straights we are not really moving places a lot, but we are so much faster in the corners, in the braking areas and in the corners. And obviously this is creating something that you just can't just wait and then accelerate, auto-accelerate people through. So this is that's exactly a very, very important subject. And the visibility in our car due to the regulation is you don't build a car which is slower to get more visibility, and with the way it is, the wheel arches and the narrow cockpits, we have bad visibility.
I was going to ask you about that, because I mean, when I was having a close look at the car, I just wondered, after all those years of driving open Audi sports cars,
It
looks extraordinarily claustrophobic. I mean, the first time you drove it, did you sort of think, not sure if I like this, or did it not bother you at all?
No, it does, because you don't see the apex in 90 degree hairpins or right corners. You see where you brake, you see the turn in, but then it disappears. You can't see where you're going. So that's bad. But I mean, on the other hand, you would say, would you make the A pillar smaller in a case you have a bad crash?
True, but
you know, there's things. I mean, for me, we can optimize things like that in the long term.
But do you have a preference for? Would you rather be in an open car or in the
actually
coupe?
I like to be in a coupe. I drove the Bentley, the 2003 Bentley.
Yeah.
I would say the regulation has changed a little bit over, and you know, the everything is optimized obviously to have very aerodynamically and performant car. In the Bentley, the wheel arches, I was sitting higher, everything was better visibility by far. In a closed car, I like that. It's certainly nice.
Sure.
Open car, really, when you speak about this, the racing, when you go to the shorter races, an open car, you have, of course, much better feeling and visibility.
Yeah.
And yes, in that sense, the Peugeot, in a way, they have done quite a lot of years in the closed car. Maybe there's a small advantage there, but I mean, the two things you mentioned is of course is misunderstandings and visibility, both forward and backwards in the modern racing we have today.
Thank you very, very much, Tom Christensen. Thank you. Well, these drivers are coming thick and fast to the motorsport table. We're very lucky, and we have with us Andy Prio. Thank you, Andy, for... I don't know if you've had to stop eating your lunch. Probably not.
No. I've been having a great lunch, nice, relaxed time with Nick Manassian and talking with Marino Franchitti and bumping into all sorts of faces from past and present of motorsport. It's been fantastic. I'm having a great time.
I was watching you this morning in the St. Mary's practice, and I'm thinking to myself, I can't remember how many times this guy's won touring car titles. I just can't remember off the top of my head. But there you are, out there, you know, on a different planet. Why are you doing it?
Oh, it's just a lovely event. It's just lovely to be part of the history of British motorsport. I mean, I'm time warped now, going back into the 1940s, and I'm a keen. Well, I've obviously loved Spitfires, and you know that era of motor racing as well. And it's just a wonderful experience. My family arriving tomorrow evening, and you know, we're just going to have a great time. And I mean, in a lot of ways, I did start off in motor racing, grassroots style, in Shelsley Walsh and hill climbing, and this is what it felt like. So it's nice to get a bit of reality every now and again.
Maybe you should just remind us how many touring car titles you have won, actually.
Well, I've won three world titles in touring car, a European title in touring car, and then of course Spider, I won a title in the British Hill Climb Championship, so I think that's six titles, and I need a few more to keep going.
Have you driven the DTM car yet?
I have, yes. I've driven a...
Yeah. Tell us what it was like.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, it's back to my single-seater days. It's got a lot of downforce. It's got carbon brakes, so they work really well. And you have to be really, really 100% committed in the car to do a lap time. That's the same in all motorsport, but you can't have a slightly off lap in this car. It's really lovely to drive, though. It's BMW are very committed to this program. It's nice for me to be part of their number one program. I've spent so many years, you know, obviously their main program was Formula One, and we were sort of 0.1% of the rest of it. So it's nice to be part of that program.
And now this is it.
Absolutely.
How many cars will there be next year? How many BMWs will be in the?
Yeah, there'll be at least, well, there will be six BMWs.
Is there
a
minimum
teams.
Requirement for entry to the championship?
I believe so. I think six is the minimum. But we hear now that Merck and Audi may run more cars. It's already started. The politics have already started. But to be honest, you know, six cars with three manufacturers isn't enough. We need a few more. We need to have at least, I think, 23, 24 cars on the grid to make it really look good. Mm. I mean, I watched at Brands 2 weeks ago, and it's a great formula. It's fast. The cars are really, really quick. The drivers are good. They're all high level. And, you know, they're all manufacturer teams. You can't really buy a drive in DTM. And in a lot of ways, that's what's nice about it, because the quality's there. So
what's always fascinated me is that it seems to be extremely specialised, I suppose. I mean, because a number of Formula One drivers at the end of their careers have gone back to DTM, and I know Hakkinen won a race or two, but don't sort of set the world on fire, do they?
We've seen that a lot in touring car racing.
Yeah, it's true.
It's hard. It's tough racing. And, you know, if you made Formula One, you're obviously a class act, but it's not easy to switch from what you know and do well, and especially at this level. I mean, I watched David Coulthard drive at Brands, and he's driving really well. If you saw him on his own, you think that guy's really quick, he's really committed, you know, and he's qualifying towards the back end of the grid. Also, I suppose, you know, in DC's case, he's obviously not in a brand new car. But it takes, I think there's not many Formula One drivers who've come in and really succeeded at this level. So I think you need to commit to one or the other. You can't do a bit of both. It's tough now with all the championships, even, you know, going to V8 Supercars in Australia and going to World Touring Car. It's all specialist and everyone's pretty good now.
Sure.
Yeah.
Andy, can I ask you about modern touring car racing? The cars are incredibly efficient, by which I mean, you know, they don't slide around a lot. Personally, I don't think it's, you know, I'm sure in the car it's a hell of a spectacle. In some ways, do you wish that, you know, you had been out in stuff like your driving here at Goodwood?
I must say that I think my driving style would suit these type of cars, because they're very forgiving. And a modern race car is very peaky. And you have to drive to the peak and a little bit over, but not too far. Otherwise, and as you say, from the outside, it doesn't look like the car's really doing a lot. But on the inside, it's all happening. And you know, the smallest little mistake, a little lock up or a little downshift that's at the wrong point costs you a tenth. And that's the difference. At Brands Hatch, 2/10 was the difference between first and 15th or 16th on the grid. So unfortunately, you have to be very clinical and very boring to be quick.
Yeah, well, you're not boring, so that's okay.
I've spoken to people about the DTM briefly, but I don't know many people who've sort of experienced it. And I'm just fascinated by the... I remember Hakkinen saying to me, you know, in many ways it's much more difficult to drive than a Formula One car was.
Well, I've had my taste of Formula One, driving and testing and stuff. And I wouldn't say Formula One is easy by any, you know, it's a tough formula. And, yeah, I mean, to win in Formula One, you have to be class act. But no better than what it takes to win in touring car. And, yeah, I mean, it's just the fact that Formula One is the... let's say the pinnacle of motorsport. It's the most marketable formula. You become a global phenomenon overnight. But there's some seriously good drivers in DTM and in other formulas.
Phenomenons
on
this program.
I think it's great BMW are in it. I'm looking forward to it.
Absolutely, me too. It's great. I'm really happy.
You may not escape immediately, actually, because we've been joined by Emanuele Pirro, who is also racing here at the Goodwood Revival. Hi, Emanuele.
Hello, everybody.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Now, my pleasure.
You're a man who knows a thing or two about driving a touring car as well, actually.
Yes, it happened that I've been driving touring cars in few occasions in my career in the last 25 years. And actually, funny enough, a month ago I was doing an historic Grand Prix in Copenhagen, and I drove a BMW 202T II, the car, the car that Andy drove last year. And talking about historic cars, this was the most modern historic car that I ever drove. And it was close to the cars that I actually started with, because my first saloon car races were with a 635 BMW, which was a really an icon. And so I really enjoyed pushing the car and then driving like the good old days that I actually witnessed.
What he didn't tell you is he won in it as well. So we both won the historic Copenhagen Grand Prix, which didn't please Tom Christensen too much.
No, I bet it didn't. I've always wanted to go there because it's such a lovely city, and I'd love to see the event too. Manueli, I've got to ask you a good question, first of all, which is, when you won the TT, you did the most amazing victory lap. I mean, that victory lap, I have never not seen anything better before or since. Would you just like to explain to us why that occurred?
Well, there's a background story. First, I am... those who know me, they know already, you know, I'm a joyful person. I'm somebody who enjoys what he's doing, and I try to share it with other people. First time I was hanging out of my car was when I won the Nürburgring 24 Hours in 1986. And since then, I actually tried to do it just because, you know, you want to share the joy with other people. And in Le Mans, first time you won it, I did step out a little bit out of the, you know, the R8, which was an open car. So I stood up a little bit, I grabbed the flag, I did the last race lap at a very, very slow pace. And this, you know, cheering everybody, and this was an amazing moment. The second year we won again, and I was in the car at the last stint. So I did again, and I stepped out a little more. And and in fact, there was a little... gadget that was given by my sons. We had they gave me two vacuum Tiger ears that you could stick suction plate Tiger ears to stick on the helmet, and you know, they were kids back then. They said, "Dad, if you wear them, you're gonna win." Of course, you can't stick a Tiger ear at 300 and, you know, 220 miles per hour, but in the last stint I put them in the pocket, and actually few hundred yards before start and finish, I stuck them in the helmet, and I crossed the line with these two Tiger ears, which, you know, all they were very proud to show the photos to their little school friends. The third year in Le Mans, we won again by, you know, a matter of luck, and then I actually stood on the car like standing the whole body outside, and this was a little bit too much for the organizers, so they gave me a hard time. Oh, and they told me not anymore. But later on, in front of a nice glass of red wine, the French people from ACO, which was not the first glass of wine, they told me, "You know what, in those days we had to give you a hard time, but we thought it was brilliant, so, you know, it was okay." Then, later on, when we were about to win for the first time with the diesel car, the Audi people, they said, "You know, we give you the pleasure to go in the car for the last stint, because it's a honor to cross the finish line, and it's a fantastic feeling." And they said, "But at one condition, you have to swear that you don't do any silly thing," because I had another plan, which was even more extreme, that I never told anybody and I will never do, to do something even more extreme. So I had to swear, and I couldn't do anything. Then Goodwood came, and, you know, because there's such a good feeling with the people, the spectators here are big part of the whole show. It's, we share the same passion, we're here for the same reasons. I would like to meet them all, and you know, I talk to all of them, because we share the same passion. So I was so happy, and just at a very, very slow speed, I removed the helmet, undone the belt, and just stepped out of the car, and I was cheering everybody and greeting, and, you know, it was really, really nice. Then stop, start, and finish. Lord March thought, this is good. Grab Dario Franchitti, my teammate, and do another parade lap like this. So one each side of the car. We do have actually some nice photos. Yeah, it's really nice.
Yeah, absolutely.
And apparently everybody liked it, apart from the stewards. So I was called by the stewards, and I thought, what did I do wrong? Normally I'm quite a fair driver, so it didn't happen very often that I went to see the stewards, and I thought, I really didn't do anything wrong. So I went there politely, hello, I'm Emanuele Pirro, what can I do for you? And they said, pointing the finger at me, you broke all the rules. Then I thought, they got the wrong guy, and I said, you know, I was driving car number XX, and my name is Pirro. I said, we know. And then he said, you broke all the rules, you endangered your life and no, everybody else's life. And I thought, I'm in candid camera. I must be in candid camera. But this was not a joke, this was truth. So apparently, it is a little bit against the rules to unbuckle yourself, but the speed was so low. And to cut the story short, I felt quite bad because the reason of the gesture was not really understood by the stewards, who have to do their job, of course. So I went back to my car owner, Bernie Carl, and he actually... I was fine, £2,500.
Were you?
Yes. £2,500. So Bernie Carl, he couldn't believe, but he's a lawyer and he's a very smart man. So what he did, and I still have it, he wrote a letter saying that this is a shame that motor racing is going for towards being bored. People are not, drivers are not longer a character, don't have charisma, and so on and so forth, really in a nice way.
Yeah.
And what Emanuele Pirro did, it should be prized because he's one of the few guys who could blah blah blah. I don't want to say too much about me, but and they said, so it basically, shame on you, because you should reward these people.
Yeah.
But to cut the story short, we completely disagree, and I include a £5,000 check because next year we'll be doing it again, so I pay in advance. And this was a really, really fantastic gesture. He really sent a check, and Lord March at the driver's briefing this year, he mentioned, and it's been just really hilarious.
Actually, it just occurs to me, speaking of stewards, you were the F1 driver advisor at Abu Dhabi last year. What was it like as an experience? Did you enjoy it?
Oh, yes.
You did?
I did. I've done it this year twice. Abu Dhabi, actually, the thing was, when we talked very early in the season, because the schedule was so busy, I could only do the last race.
Right.
And I thought, okay, last race, in fact, is not too bad because it's not a big responsibility. Things will be settled down and, you know, there's not too much work. But the idea, actually, I think is really good because the drivers actually appreciate it, and it's in drivers' interest to have a driver between them, between the stewards. And it has been basically well taken by almost the whole Formula One community, in my opinion. But unfortunately, it was getting close and close to the last race, and we all remember there were three drivers fighting for the championship, and I was there as nervous as you couldn't believe. And then there were even speculation articles written, saying that I'm a Ferrari fan and whatever, which is absolutely wrong. Because if they knew that, you know, I've been in Formula One thanks to McLaren, I have been sponsored by Red Bull, I had never had anything to do with Ferrari. So definitely,
no.
And actually, I don't care, but in a way, I took it a little bit as an offense, because really, when you wear an FIA shirt, you really feel you have a responsibility, and there are no friends, there are no flags, there are no colors.
No.
You just really try to do your job.
No, you were right to take offense. Yeah. I mean, I couldn't believe some of the things that those guys
were
writing.
But the good thing is that majority of the community actually took my side, and I got a lot of sympathy also in the internet, and a lot of people were really backing me up. So this made me feel quite good, actually.
Yeah.
Manuele, before we finish, can you just tell us all what you're racing at the Goodwood Revival, and what kind of experience Friday practice has been so far for you?
Well, this year I made myself very busy, but you know, opportunities are there, and it's so difficult to refuse them. I've always been driving the TT, so it's a race that I don't want to miss. But normally in the TT, I've been driving an E-Type Jaguar, the 4WPD, which is, of course, it's not my car, but I feel very attached to it. and there is a Jaguar celebration, E-Type celebration. Sure. So I do the TT with another car, with an AC Cobra. Then I drive my on brackets E-Type TT WPD. But then there was the opportunity to drive Jimmy Clark's Lotus Cortina.
Oh.
And you know, Jimmy Clark is I mean, I don't want to mention God, because God is God, of course. I'm Catholic and everything, but yeah. Jimmy Clark is Jimmy Clark. So to sit in the car where he started his career is a dream. Therefore, I'm also driving this car.
That too. Fantastic. Marvellous.
Well, I think that's a good note to end on, Nigel. Yeah, I mean, we're talking about Jimmy Clark, Lotus Cortina, Goodwood, Manuele Pirro, who surely is the absolute embodiment of motor racing fan, apart from anything else. I mean, just such a good guy. Thank you so much for coming along.
My pleasure. My pleasure. And as I say often, every time I come here, it's a surprise, because you never get used to these things. It's so fantastic. And we're all blessed to be here. So we try to enjoy it. And see you around.
On that note, thanks. From the driver's mess, the Rolex driver's mess at the Goodwood Revival, we say goodbye for another Motorsport Magazine podcast. And I tell you what, nowhere else in the world will you have so many wonderful racing drivers on one podcast at one time. See you next time. Bye-bye.
You can save over 23% and receive a free DVD, Deadliest Crash, the 1955 Le Mans disaster, when you subscribe to Motorsport today. 3 years in the making and using rediscovered and restored cine footage, the film includes eyewitness accounts from the Mercedes and Jaguar teams, plus stories from the spectators. It's a DVD all motor racing fans should own. Call 020 7349 8472 or visit motorsportmagazine.com to receive 12 issues for as little as £46.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Motorsport Magazine, for the very best in motor racing.